The title of today's forum is What is the Economy Good For Anyway? And I will introduce Tom Maloney, who will then introduce the succession of our guests.
Thanks very much. I'm Tom Maloney. I'm the chair of the Department of Economics here and also the director of the Tanner Human Rights Center. And it's my great pleasure to be able to welcome John DeGraff to the University of Utah. How many of you have taken an economics class? Why have you not taken an economics class? You just taken an economics class. If you've taken an economics class, at some point in the class, your professor has said, let's assume people are rational. Let's assume people have full information. Let's assume there's perfect competition. This is always part of economic analysis, and it's really necessary to get a grasp of challenging issues in complex systems. But it's also important to question assumptions, and it seems to me that's what John DeGraff's work really encourages us to do, especially in his talk today. He encourages us to question basic assumptions and even the sort of unspoken assumptions that we carry around, like the unstated assumption that growth is always good, that growth as measured by greater output through increase in the gross domestic product must be a good thing. Surely, if we have more stuff, we must be better off. DeGraff's talk today and in much of his work really encourages us to question those assumptions. He encourages us to take a more full account of what we give up to get more stuff, so our degradation to the environment, maybe to our health, to human relationships. He also encourages us to examine whether more stuff really makes us happier. That assumed connection, is that really present? This approach to economics, questioning basic assumptions, questioning sometimes unspoken assumptions, I think fits very well with the way we do economics at the University of Utah. We emphasize looking outside of mathematical models to history, to the history of ideas, to institutional context, to insights from other disciplines to enrich the tools of more mainstream methods. And we have students and faculty here, including my colleague Gunsali Barak, who works directly on some of the kinds of measures that John will talk about today. I'll be using one of his books in my class next term, so I'm very eager to hear his talk to make sure I get that right. So we're very happy to have John DeGraff with us today. Let me first, though, introduce my colleague Tariq Benouri, the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning and the Department of Economics, who has brought this all about today, and he'll introduce our guest. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Tom, and thank you to all of you for coming and listening to this talk. Let me first of all say a couple of things. I want to thank Tom Maloney and the Economics Department in particular for hosting John DeGraff and supporting his travel and enabling him to be here. I also would like to thank the University of Utah's sustainability program, now headed by the illustrious Professor Amy Wildermuth, who has very kindly agreed to join us today, both for the support that she has provided and for the interest in advancing the sustainability agenda at the university. Professor Jim Ehlerman, who is the head of the Global Change and Sustainability Center, a pioneer in cross-disciplinary work, research work at the university on sustainability. Again, also not only for his kindness in being here and willing to say a few words, but also bringing some of the graduate students together to sit with John today at lunch. And also a special thank to Professor Brenda Bowen, the co-director of the program on the Global Change and Sustainability Center. And while I'm talking about Brenda, I also noticed Professor Dan McCool sitting there, who has put together this wild and scenic film festival today, which I encourage all of you to go and see. It turns out that the Wild and Scenic Film Festival has an award in honor of John DeGraff for the environmental movie. So it's quite a coincidence that John is here on the exact same day, and we will show our face. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I have the great pleasure of introducing John DeGraff. I do think that, you know, it's one of those amazing coincidences that here is somebody whose work I have followed for years and years, and the first time that I met him was yesterday when I picked him up at the airport. We were both together on the King of Bhutan's panel on alternative paradigm for development, the happiness panel, And we both attended some of the meetings organized by the Bhutanese government, but never the same meeting. We were both interacting with other colleagues. For instance, Professor Julie Shore, who's now at Boston College, previously at Harvard University, who has done amazing work both in feminist economics and you might have heard about overworked economics. Julie and I have worked together. We did a book together quite some time ago on economic liberalization, global economic liberalization. And Julie and John have worked together on the value of time, the overworked American, and the ideas of how to actually redefine economics in a way that is much more consistent with our values. Nancy Folbray, Jim Boyce, my colleagues at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst when I first started teaching were actually instrumental in enabling John to put together the book, What is the Economy For Anyway? So, I mean, in some sense, we find that, this tremendous overlap between our concerns. Now, John's work. He did this famous work called Affluenza, the disease called affluence. It's a disease that all of us suffer from, and I hope that one of these days, thanks to work of people like John, we will get over this disease. What is the economy for anyway? Redefining the economy to be something that furthers our values rather than something which is completely outside of ourselves, and take back our time in particular, one of the things that he's going to talk about today. So I'm absolutely delighted that he's going to come and share these ideas with us. I hope also that he will talk about the Bhutan King of Bhutan panel, particularly the very important work that the King of Bhutan has started in redefining welfare and redefining progress. So I'm very pleased to welcome you, John. I'm very happy that you're here. I'm very happy that we have met, and I'm very happy that all of the people have come out to see you. I have one pleasant duty to perform before I hand over the thing to you. My colleagues in the College of City, College of Arts and Architecture and Planning, since they did not pay for your travel, they said we have to do something. So on their behalf, a representative of local arts and local pottery, we would like very much to take this. Can somebody take a picture? The dean and the faculty of the College of Arts and Planning, and they would like you to remember us for...
Well, thank you. Should we open it now and show it to people?
It won't explode. You can open it, but I suggest that you can leave it.
Well, I think just so that everyone has a chance to see this work of art, we should do this. See if I can open it without causing any damage to it.
Yeah, it's going to take you a while.
Oh! All right. Well, we'll get there. That's why we have 2 hours for this session. I knew there was a reason for that. I'm not being very successful here.
Yeah, they did a good job in closing it. Yeah.
They did a very good job. You're just going to use brute force. This is it. When in doubt, use brute force. Wow. Oh, beautiful. Here we go. The artist is Hermine Testard, based here in Salt Lake City, and you can see this, and thank you very much, and thank you to your department.
Thank you for joining me.
I better move this so you have a place to sit, Tariq.
No, you can just leave it there. one other thing is that I am the editor of a journal called Development, which actually takes a very sustainability orientation. We are hoping very much that John and people who are his students, in reality, if not even literally, will write for us. So I thought I would take this opportunity of presenting you a copy of the latest issue of Development.
Thank you very much.
I hope you have a chance to read it, and you will contribute to it.
I'll
these
be
words,
delighted.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very happy to give to you John DeGraff. John?
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you very much, and thanks to everyone who were responsible for my being here. This is a great delight. Thank you particularly to Dr. Bonnery for inviting me here in the first place and helping to make this possible. This is a great crowd. I hope I don't disappoint all of you folks here. But I wanted to start with a little background. I just learned that this institute was started in 1965, which just so happens is also the first year that I ever came to the University of Utah. And I happened to be 18 years old at the time. I didn't come here to go to school. I had been at the University of California at Berkeley for 1 year, and school and I hadn't gotten along particularly well, and I wanted to do something else. I was just eager to get out in the world a little bit. You know how students take a gap year now and such, and we didn't do it as much then, but I needed it. So I ended up joining the Domestic Peace Corps called VISTA. This was the first year of President Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, which you may have certainly heard of. And in fact, next year will be the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's famous Great Society speech, which he gave as a commencement speech at the University of Michigan in May of 1964. One of the significant things that people don't remember about that speech is that it was one of the best and first critiques of the whole concept of economic growth as being the be-all and end-all of what we do. In fact, Lyndon Johnson warned Americans in that speech that we were in danger of having the things that we value, our environment, the beauty of our society, all of those things to be basically drowned by unbridled economic growth. And that's exactly the term that he used in that. He said, really, we're going to be judged here not on the quantity of our goods, but on the quality of our goals and the quality of our lives. And he said, you know, we needed what we've done for the last 50 years. We needed to build a strong economy so we could have the basic things for people. But the real test of the next 50 years is what we do to improve the quality of our lives, not the quantity of our stuff. Now, I don't know that we've paid much attention to what Lyndon Johnson said at the University of Michigan that day, but I joined VISTA, and it just so happened that I was sent here to the University of Utah to train for VISTA in the summer of 1965, still 18 years old, just turned 19, in fact, at the end of the training. And then they sent me to an Indian reservation in northern Wisconsin called the Bad River Chippewa Reservation, where I spent the next 2 years. And that was, for me, a huge life-changing event. I came from suburban California. I had never experienced or seen real poverty. I had never really seen the kind of racism that was clear toward those Native American kids and things. And it changed me enormously. It changed me in my goals and what I wanted to do. And I then went to the University of Wisconsin and studied sociology. But my activism took me in a different direction, finally leading me into the world of filmmaking. And for 20-some years, that's all I did, was to make my films about the issues, primarily environmental and social issues, that were important to me. Until 1997, when I did the film Affluenza. And that particular film struck a chord. It was my Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame that we all get, a mini hit. And it led to my being asked to write a book on the subject and to do a lot of speaking and to really get in again as an activist into the issues that I was making films about, particularly the issue of overconsumption. And that led me to form an organization with a group of people called Take Back Your Time, with the idea that one of the things that we give up as folks to have this society of endless growth and endless consumption is that we work ourselves to death to obtain it. I was a sociology student in 1968 at the University of Wisconsin, and I was told in a social problems class that by the year 2000, there would be an enormous social problem in the United States which we sociologists were going to have to help solve. Does anyone want to guess what that problem was going to be? Just call it out. Ah, yeah. Okay. So there's always, I realize this is another one of these audiences where I can probably walk out the door now because you kind of know all the answers. But yes, the problem was going to be that with automation and with this thing called cybernation, this coming computer revolution that we are all now part of, by the year 2000, the estimates were that Americans would work 15 to 20 hours a week in paid labor. They would have 7 to 10 weeks of vacation a year, and we would all have so much leisure time on our hands we wouldn't know what to do with it. And I thought, wow, there's a problem I can deal with. But of course that's not the problem we had, and it became clear with the work of Juliet Shore and others by the early 90s that in fact we were working longer than we had been working in the 60s, and we were paying for that in enormous ways. And my work on time, which led particularly to an effort to, which I'll talk about a little bit later, to get a paid vacation law passed in the U.S. Congress, unsuccessful effort, of course, led me to be recognized by some people in Bhutan and elsewhere for whom the issue of time balance is essential to their concepts of happiness. And so I was invited to speak at two conferences in Brazil, international conferences on happiness, and that led to my further being invited, as Dr. Bonnery was, to be part of this working group with the Prime Minister of Bhutan and the Cabinet of Bhutan to enhance happiness there. So those are just my prefacing remarks. Now I want to get into this main thing, which is really happiness, time, and sustainability. And I think I should first mention what I mean by happiness, because this is a term that actually makes a lot of people nervous. They get a little bit freaked out by this term. And I want to indicate that I do not mean by this simple momentary pleasure. That by happiness, I mean a sense of a life well lived. At the end of the life, that one says, I am satisfied. I feel good about this life that I lived. That in any point in our lives, that we feel that way. That's the important thing to me. And that was brought home to me particularly by my personal hero. I think all of us have personal heroes. And my personal hero was a man named David Brower. Some of you may have heard of him. I made a PBS documentary about his life for Earth Day 1990. He is the man who built the Sierra Club, founded Friends of the Earth, kept dams out of the Grand Canyon, stopped dams from Dinosaur National Monument, helped create many national parks, and a very significant figure in my life and in my belief about sustainability. And I got to know David Brower well, and we were friends for the last 28 years of his life, and I now sit on the board of the organization he formed called Earth Island Institute. But my last time seeing David Brower was about 5 days before he died in the year 2000. And it was at a place called Alta Bates Hospital in Berkeley, California. And it was clear that the end was near. He was in the final stages of cancer. He'd had several bouts, but this time he wasn't going to recover. And it was kind of a grim time to be together. But as I left, I kind of wanted, I like to look on the bright side of things, you know, happiness and all that. So I said to him, well, David, I hope that the next time I see you, you'll be out there healthy again and fighting the good fight. And he looked me straight in the eye, and I'll never forget this, and he said, John, I don't think that's in the cards, but it's been a great 88 years. And I think that's what we all want to say. However many years we have, I think we want to be able to say, this life meant something. I did something. I'm glad I did this. That to me is what I'm talking about when I think of happiness. It's satisfaction with a life well lived. I think that's Thomas Jefferson's definition, many others. Now, David Brower, I believe, died a happy man in terms of this sense of satisfaction for his life, but he also died a man tremendously concerned about the fate of future generations. And, this one. All right. So, in the last years of his life, David Brower used to give what he called his sermon. It took him about 10 minutes to deliver this sermon. I'm going to try to do it in one. for you to sum it up, but I think it's a way of thinking about just how urgent our circumstances are at this particular time. So what David Brower did was he compressed the age of the Earth, estimated by scientists at some 4.6 billion years, into a single week, the biblical week of creation, if you want to look at it that way. And if you do that, what you find is that a day represents about 650 million years, an hour 27 million, a minute 450,000 years, and a second 7,500 years. Now, when you think about that, what you find is that, where are we here? I'm missing something. Okay, sorry about this. In any case, Earth begins on Sunday morning, and life comes for the first time around sometime on Tuesday afternoon. In the next few years, it becomes ever larger, more complex, and more wondrous, until about noon on the last day, Saturday, the final day, those big reptiles, the biggest of these animals, arrive on the planet, the dinosaurs. And they have a rather long run. They last for 4 or 5 hours until finally around 4 or 5 in the afternoon on Saturday, their time on the planet is ended by an asteroid in the Gulf of Mexico, which makes the climate too cool for them to survive, and they are replaced by the mammals. At 3 minutes before midnight on the final night, Saturday night, we human beings arrive on the planet. Remember, this is the last night, 3 minutes before midnight. At a third of a second before midnight, Buddha is born. It's funny because there's two there's two things. The next one comes up and I'm looking at the wrong one. Sorry about this. At 1/3 of a second before midnight on the final night, Buddha is born. At a quarter of a second before midnight on the final night, Christ is born. At 1/125th of a second on that last Saturday night, 25th of a second before midnight, the Industrial Revolution begins. And at 1/100th of a second before midnight, this consumer society, which we have been part of since World War II, arrives. Remember, this is the blink of a geological eye. This is a tiny, tiny amount of time. And during that time, that 1/100th of a second, we have used more resources than all human beings who ever lived throughout all time, all put together, did before that time. We have reduced our soils, our fisheries, our fossil fuels, and who knows what other resources by half or more. We have driven countless species to extinction, and we are noticeably changing the climate of the Earth. Think about what it means that we have done all of this in such a tiny fraction of time. And you will understand that we can't grow on like this, that we simply cannot assume that we can continue doing what we've been doing. Brower said that there are people who will say that what we have been doing for the last 1/100th of a second can go on indefinitely. They are considered reasonable, normal, intelligent people. In fact, they run our corporations, they run our government, they run all kinds of things. But in reality, they are stark, raving, mad. This is simply not going to continue, and so we have to figure out something else. Now, the good news is that we can live within the limits of the Earth. We can grow without we don't have to grow without limit to have good lives, and that beyond modest levels of comfort, expansion of the gross domestic product does not have a major impact on our well-being. This is the so-called Easterlin paradox. It's been challenged quite a bit lately, but I believe that essentially it's absolutely correct that the gains that come after a certain point often come at greater costs and so forth. GDP, Dr. Maloney mentioned this also, we measure things by this thing, the gross domestic product. We have the world's grossest domestic product. But it is a notoriously bad measure of well-being because it really adds all the stuff that we pay money for. It's the market value, total market final value of everything we produce in the society in a given year. And so it includes things like the cost of cleaning up oil spills, the cost of taking care of cancer, the cost of dealing with divorce, the cost of these various defensive expenditures that do not, are really taking care of the things that we've already messed up with limitless growth. Robert Kennedy said it best in a speech he made when he was running for president in March of 1968. It's a wonderful speech. You can find it online. But what he said in the end was, it measures, in short, everything except that which makes life worthwhile. Now, that's pretty straightforward and I think pretty accurate. We have a debate in this country. The debate is really not about growth because we all assume, both political parties and people generally, assume that growth is just simply a good thing. After all, we're all for growth. In fact, Charlie Rose was just doing an interview on PBS a couple of nights ago, and that's what he said to his guest. Well, we're all for growth. Now the question is how we get there. And when we look at that, we really have an argument in this society between two ideas. One is austerity, and the other is stimulus. We're going to get to grow the economy better this way. But the question we don't ask is, first of all, austerity for whom? Are we going to continue to demand greater austerity from people who already are hungry, people who already are poor, people who already don't have access to health, or so forth, while we demand no austerity from the people at the top who have seen their incomes mushroom and explode over the past 30 years? And then secondly, when we ask about growth or stimulus, growth of what? What should grow? If we believe in growth, then what should grow? But what's going to shrink if we're somehow to live within planetary limits? Now, the nation of Bhutan has taken this on. In 1972, Bhutan's then 16-year-old king, upon his coronation, was asked by an Australian reporter, "So, King, what are you going to do to increase your country's gross national product?" That's what we called it then. And the king paused for a moment and he said, "Well, you know, with all due respect, sir, I think that gross national happiness is more important than gross national product." You know, kids say the darnest things. And he said that. And if one of our leaders had said that, imagine President Obama saying that or something, we would, you know, at best, we would yawn, smile politely, and go back to the business of making money. But the people of Bhutan take the king seriously. They wanted to actually figure out how do we operationalize this concept of gross national happiness. They even wrote it into their constitution that the purpose of their government is the attainment of gross national happiness for the people. And over the years, they brought experts from many, many countries to their country to talk to them about what makes people happy? What accounts for well-being? How scientifically can we understand that? And they came up with 9 domains, as they call them, and these are those domains. One is living standards. We understand that up to a point, you got to have the stuff. You have to have the basic economic security. So we don't ignore that, but it's not the only thing we look at. Secondly, physical health. Third, and in this case, I think we can see in the United States that we're hurting in comparison to other wealthy countries. We really have the lowest life expectancy, some of the worst numbers where health is concerned, despite the fact that we're spending almost twice as much on health care each year than other countries. Mental health, community vitality, social connection. We know how important this is for happiness and for health, that we have this kind of connection. The worst thing you can do for both your happiness and for your health is to be lonesome. I don't know how many of you have seen the report done by Time magazine and the American Association of Retired Persons using a study by University of California at Los Angeles about chronic loneliness in the United States. What they found is that for Americans over the age of 45, in the past decade alone, the number of those Americans who can be categorized as chronically lonely, that is, they don't have friends, they don't have social connection, they don't have support, has risen from 20% of that over 45 population to 35% in a decade. When you think about this, you have to understand what kind of a disaster this will be for our society if this continues. It is not only a personal tragedy for those people who are lonely, it will be an enormous health problem for all of us because we understand the impacts of this on all kinds of chronic diseases, from heart disease to high blood pressure, all of these things. So we will pay for this in a big way. So community vitality, social connection, hugely important. Cultural vitality, access to things like art and music and theater and all of this, an important thing for us. These non-material aspects of life that we have tended to take for granted and think of, in a sense, when we think of GDP, often think of as a waste of time, essentially. Government, democratic government, participatory government, transparent, not controlled and dominated by the power of money. And when the king found out that democratic government was essential to happiness, he abdicated and turned Bhutan into the world's most recent parliamentary democracy. So he understood that he couldn't continue to have a monarchy if he really believed that democracy was important for happiness. Education, and this is not just formal education, but the whole idea of lifelong learning, and people who are keeping their mind going, who are curious, who are interested, who are learning things, have less need to be entertained, to get their pleasures and things from simply piling on more and more stuff. Environmental quality and access to nature, and we know how important access to green space, to things like this is to us. I can go through many of these things, but it will take much too long. Finally, the one that I'm most interested in, time balance, the understanding that having sufficient leisure, not being constantly stressed for time and hurried for time, is essential to a high quality of life. And the Bhutanese are very aware of this. We in the United States are suffering from enormous problems caused by time pressure, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. Now, Bhutan does not include the domain of work satisfaction, but the Gallup organization has pointed out the importance of that in a society like ours, where most people are working in large institutions, in factories, in offices, and so forth. In Bhutan, most people tend to be small farmers, peasant farmers, and so forth. Their conditions of work are not very different from each other, but in our society, the satisfaction of work life is hugely important. So I went to Bhutan as part of the group that Dr. Bonnery mentioned, and we were asked to put together a report for the United Nations around these domains and around the whole concept of measuring happiness. And what we found was that we had some major disagreements. There were about 45 of us so-called experts from 20, 25 different countries, and we had two fundamental disagreements. And those disagreements were between the people who believed that happiness and well-being is primarily the result of the conditions of life and of public policies that change those conditions of life, on the one hand, and on the other hand, people who believe that happiness and well-being is primarily the result of personal attitudes and behaviors and personal change. And this was an object of conflict. It was about 50-50, probably a little bit more leaning toward policy in that group. But nonetheless, we had differences. The second difference was between the people who like the term happiness and the people who hate the term happiness. And a lot of public policy and academic people really kind of get nervous when they hear the term happiness. It just implies Hallmark cards and things like that. They just don't, they're very uneasy with this. And they prefer this term well-being. And on the other hand, there are other folks who find the term well-being kind of academic and wonkish, and to put it bluntly, boring. So what is there a right word in all of this? And so we were arguing about these things and bickering. And a gentleman named Enrico Giovannini, I'm sure you know him, who is currently the Minister of Labor and Social Issues in the Italian government, stood up, and we were outside, and we were having lunch in a kind of a ring of tents where the food was, and there was a sort of sandy space in the middle, and Enrico took a stick, and he said, "We need to stop this bickering. We need to understand that all of these points are accurate. We just have to see them in their context. And so I'm going to draw how I think this ought to look." And he created this diagram, this paradigm, which of course starts out with the fact that whatever we do, we have to do in the boundaries of the earth. We cannot go out somewhere else. So sustainability is essential to this. And the economy, the development paradigm, the economic institutions, the social institutions, and so forth, really essentially take resources, which we now often call forms of capital. You've probably heard the term social capital, human capital, natural capital, and so forth, and use those resources to meet human needs. I don't want to go into the whole explanation of that, because the more important thing is to say, then how do we know how well we're doing? And Giovannini said, we need to think then about well-being, this term well-being, as that which we can, those conditions of life which we can measure through objective data. So, for example, if we take Bhutan's domains, which we talked about before, and we take something like health as one of the domains, then we look at things like life expectancy and infant mortality and obesity and all of these things. These are the ways that we measure well-being. And this kind of well-being is the goal of public policy. It's to set minimum standards and improve those standards and spread them as widely as possible to the population, what I talk about in What's the Economy For Anyway, as the greatest good for the greatest number over the longest run. This comes from Gifford Pinchot, the first head of the U.S. Forest Service. So Giovannini says this is well-being. And this is properly the stuff of public policy. We want to improve well-being across the board for people, and we can measure it objectively in these areas. Now, on the other hand, there is also happiness, and happiness is a different thing. Happiness is what you might also refer to as subjective well-being. It's those aspects of life that we measure through subjective surveys when we ask people, for example, in health, how do you feel about your health? My health is excellent. It's good. It's poor. I'm in pain a lot. I can't do the things I need to do. These are the happiness measures, and they are subjective measures. Now, Giovannini went further, and he said that in between those two things, we have a mediating factor which is called happiness skills. And these happiness skills... Whoops, where are we? Where are we? Okay. These happiness skills are the goal of personal change and the goal of education. You can educate for these kinds of things. They come from our ancient wisdom traditions and religious traditions. They come from modern neuroscience. They come from positive psychology. They can be taught. And they include various kinds of things. I'm just have a list of a few of them here: compassion, generosity, sociability, tolerance, curiosity, patience, mindfulness. These are things that the happiness science has shown can make people have better lives, whatever the conditions of their lives may be. And it doesn't mean that they can make a person who has horrible conditions of life be greatly, greatly happy, but they're very important. So there's a purpose for personal change as well. He said, for example, let's say you increase time balance because you give people more leisure time, you shorten work hours, you give people vacation time, some of the things that I was working on. If people use that extra time simply to watch television, they're not likely to be a whole lot happier. In fact, they might be less happy. They will be subjected to more images telling them you got to have this in order to be happy. They will exercise less. They will be out in nature less. They will connect less with other people. All kinds of things that we know are important for happiness. So you have to have both of these things, and then you go going back to, where am I? Oh, okay. And happiness you measure through using these surveys, as I mentioned, and we are seeing a lot of this happening around the world today. A variety of countries are actually assessing this. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has a thing called the Better Life Index. The UK now measures life satisfaction for people and publishes those statistics with its GDP. The one that I have been most connected with is a thing called the Happiness Initiative. You can find that at happycounts.org. And what you will find there is a survey that looks at all of these domains or dimensions of life and asks you about five questions in each of those domains. Questions that the San Francisco State Psychology Department found to be most correlated to happiness and to well-being. So when you take that test, it takes you about 15 minutes. When you finish it, you get an immediate score that tells you how well you are doing in each of these domains of life and also what the national average in the United States of the 40,000 people who have taken the survey is. So you get some sense of how you compare to others. You can see, you know, where you may get red flags. This aspect of my life, it's not going so well. I need to think about this. What we find is that in the United States, the lowest scores across the board are in two areas. One is government, confidence in government. That may not surprise you. And in fact, if we were doing it this month, that might be the very lowest score. But generally, it has been the second lowest score. And the lowest score is in this area of time balance. Americans very, very stressed for time. So we can measure these things. One of the things that we're doing is working with communities around the United States. We've worked with cities like Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Santa Fe, New Mexico, where I'll be going this weekend, and a number of other cities on using this survey community-wide to measure how well a city is doing in all of these dimensions. It's very valuable for the city to think about this in terms of policy, and it's also very useful for policymakers, because policymakers can get all the objective data. They can say, we've improved these conditions, crime has gone down, and so forth. But they also want to know how people feel about their lives, because crime may have gone down, but if people are watching a steady diet of crime shows and believe that crime has gone up and they have less trust and they're more and more nervous and more worried, they might still throw you out of office despite what you have done that's positive. So we need these kind of things. And one thing I'd love to talk to would be with some people who might be interested in using the Happiness Initiative survey, both here at the University of Utah. We've worked with many colleges who have done this on a college-wide basis, and we find it's engaging for students. It gets them to think about various aspects of their lives that they might not think about otherwise, and to use it in a community. And I think Salt Lake would be a great place for this. So we find the lowest score in time balance, and how can we deal with this in terms of policy? Because we're here in a policy institute, so I want to just talk a tiny bit about some of the policies I think can be important in our country for improving time balance, because people feel this, they feel stressed, they feel overworked, and in fact, this is having enormous negative effect on our health, on our social connection, many other things, including the environment. And one of my friends, who's a cardiologist, Sarah Speck, who's the head of the cardiovascular wellness program at the biggest hospital in Seattle, says that time stress and work stress are the new tobacco. That really, we've done a tremendous positive job in the United States in reducing smoking. We have led the world in this. We have really focused on this, and we have been very, very successful. But at the same time, if you look at it, you can, and she uses a PowerPoint to show you your arteries on tobacco and your arteries on time stress and work stress. And what you see is over time the same thing happens. The arteries constrict, and you see these increases in various diseases to the point where if you live in the United States today, believe it or not, this is a long-term Emory University study reported on by the Los Angeles Times, you have almost double the chance of having heart disease, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, cancer, and arthritis than you would after the age of 50, nearly twice as much chance as you would if you lived in Europe. Now think about it. That's stunning. Those numbers are huge because it is precisely those chronic illnesses which cost so much to treat. And even if we didn't have such a crazy healthcare system, and even if we did a single-payer system or something like that that was more efficient and more bang for the buck, we'd still be paying more than other countries because we are so unhealthy. So how can we improve time balance? Well, one of the first things we need to think about is providing family leave for parents when they have a child. And we are unique in the fact that we don't do this. There are only 4 countries in the entire world today, the United States, Swaziland, Liberia, and Papua New Guinea, that do not at least provide paid maternity leave for mothers when they have a child. And among rich countries, all other rich countries also provide some paid time off for dads. In some cases, very little, but at least some paid time off for dads. We don't do it. This has immense effect on children's health, on various other kinds of things. And it makes life very stressful for parents right from the bat, right off the bat in our society. Another thing is paid sick days. Some cities have this now. We won a campaign in Seattle to guarantee some paid sick days for workers. But we're really the only rich country in the world that doesn't guarantee paid time off when you're sick. What is the effect of this? People come to work sick. They get other people sick. 86% of workers in the food service restaurant industry in the United States receive 0 paid sick days. They are also often the lowest paid workers. They come to work sick. They stay sick longer. They make you sick. This is not rocket science. It makes a difference to pay up front for some of these kind of things to take care of them. And the third one here, again, as I mentioned, is vacations. There are only 5 countries in the world that do not mandate any paid vacation time for workers. We are one of them. The other 4 are Suriname, Guyana, Nepal, and Burma. That's it. Every other country in the world mandates at least some minimum paid vacation time for workers. Why does this matter? Well, we know that people who don't regularly take vacations are twice as likely to suffer from heart disease. Women who don't regularly take vacations are as much as 8 times more likely to suffer from depression than those who do. The consequences of this very, very high in many, many ways. Another one is the whole idea of shortening the work week, shortening work hours generally. And here there's an interesting cost, a case to look at, because we sometimes don't want to do this, although by sharing work, we could actually reduce unemployment in a way that wouldn't add to more and more limitless growth. Now, a good example of this is Amador County, California, where in 2009, the state of California was running a $35 billion budget deficit, and it told the counties that it was going to give them less money to carry out their activities from the state. And so in Amador County, a very conservative county, the county supervisors, all conservative Republicans, said, well, we are going to have to cut our budget, but we don't want to lay people off. So what we're going to do is we're going to shorten work hours. We are going to go to a 4-day work week. We're going to close the offices on Friday. You're going to work 9 hours a day, 36 hours a week, and we will cut salaries by 10%. This was the conservatives. I agree with them. I think this was the fair and best thing to do, and as you can probably guess, I'm not all that conservative. But what happened? Well, the workers exploded. The union, SEIU, representing all of them, said, you can't do this. We'd rather have you lay off the people at the bottom, but You can't take this money. We can't possibly live with 10% less income, all of this kind of stuff. And the county supervisor said, well, you don't have a choice because we are not going to lay off workers. But 2 years from now, we'll give you a choice. You put up with this for now, and in 2 years, if the situation is the same, you can vote and decide whether you want to go back to 5-day week, full pay, and lay people off, if we have to lay people off, or whatever you want to do. 2 weeks late, 2 years later, the financial situation had not changed significantly, and the union members were asked to vote on this, and they voted 71% to 29% to keep the shorter work week with less pay. They had learned through that experience the importance of time. In fact, they talked about what it meant to have that Friday off each week, what it meant for their families, what it meant for many other things. So we can begin to move in a direction like this, and as people actually experience these things, they can appreciate them. Now, we shouldn't have to do it by fiat. We shouldn't have to do it by forcing people to do this. We should be thinking about what a country like the Netherlands does, and now Germany and Belgium are following suit, and I think the European Union will soon. In 2000, the Netherlands passed what was called the Working Hours Adjustment Act. What this act says is that you can go to your employer and you can say, I'd like to reduce my work time, 5 days a week to 4 days to 3, something like that. Unless your employer can show a hardship for the firm, the employer is required to grant you that request. Now, you make less money because you're working fewer hours, but you keep the same hourly salary. Your benefits like vacation time, pension, and stuff are prorated, and you keep your health care because that's a universal right in every other wealthy country. What does this mean? It means that people are free to make choices of time over money, and they are doing it in a big way. So what we see now is that the majority of families with children in the Netherlands, both parents are working part-time, or often at least one parent is working part-time in the family. We see that the Netherlands has the highest percentage of part-time work in the world, some 46% of the workforce. And we see some enormous positive effects from this, which I will go into. I'm almost wrapping up here, but I've got a few more things. So if we look internationally, this is what we see. We see from Gallup's poll, and you can look up the UN World Happiness Report for 2013. Go to the second chapter, and you will see all the scores internationally based on the Gallup World Poll for happiness in some 150 countries in the world, all but the very smallest countries. And this is how it comes down, and it's been fairly consistent for many years. Gallup finds that the five happiest countries in the world are these countries in this order: Denmark, Norway, Switzerland, the Netherlands, and Sweden. All but Switzerland have very short working hours. In fact, the Netherlands and Norway have the shortest working hours in the world. The Swiss don't have particularly long working hours, but they're longer than these other countries. All of these countries have very strong social safety nets. They protect people. They take care of people. They are among the most egalitarian countries in the world. They have the smallest gaps between rich and poor. We in the United States have the widest gap between rich and poor of any wealthy country. And they are the countries, believe it or not, despite what we hear, they are the countries that pay the highest taxes. And these are consistently the countries where people report the greatest life satisfaction. Gallup is very clear on this. Now, people will say, well, that's their business. I'm not going to go into policy like that because, after all, these are nanny states. And we're not going to, you know, we want people to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and do what they need to do. So I say, well, let's then go take this a step farther, and let's look at the well-being of children in the world today. So, because I think we can all agree that 5-year-olds can't pick themselves up by their bootstraps. 10-year-olds will have a little problem pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. They need a little help, a little head start to in life. So UNICEF publishes a report called Child Well-Being in Rich Countries. You can look this up on Google, check it out. And it takes 29 of the world's richest countries, that for which we have a lot of data, and it takes five key areas of life objectively, which are material well-being, poverty rates, and so forth. It takes health, it takes education, it takes risky behaviors and safety of kids, and it takes environmental quality for kids. And then it takes one subjective area, which is how the kids assess their own life satisfaction. And here's the result. The United States ranks number 26 out of 29 countries in the UNICEF survey of child well-being. The only countries that fall lower than the United States on that report are Lithuania, Latvia, and Romania. These are, again, of rich countries. Now, in subjective well-being, that is how American kids report how they feel about their lives, we do a little better. We rank 23rd. Now, what country ranks on top? By a long margin, the Netherlands. And one of the reasons that comes out clearly is because their parents have time for them. Again, this is not rocket science. And when we think about policy, we have to understand where this came from. This didn't come from socialists. It didn't come from the far left, these policies. It actually came from what in the Netherlands is the conservative party, the Christian Democratic Party. Now, by American terms, they're not all that conservative, but they are, in the Netherlands, the right-wing party. And what happened was, in the late 1990s, the Christian Democratic Party had a whole national campaign around, guess what? They called it family values. They said, let's value families. And if we want to value families, how might we do that? Well, one way we could do that is to give parents time with their kids and to ensure that children have the kind of things they need to grow up to be healthy and all of these things. And so these are the results. They're very clear. You can look at the studies and see. You see one place we do really well, American kids smoke and drink less than people in these other countries. But it goes way downhill from there in the other factors. And I encourage people to have a look at that and to think, how can we make this better? Now, when Canada found out they were number 17 in this survey, this was the front page news headline in all the major Canadian dailies, and the Canadians were aghast at this. In the United States, where we ranked 26, we hardly yawned. I mean, there was no key reporting on this in the papers. It wasn't even an issue. Something as significant as the well-being of our children in comparison to others doesn't make the papers here. What's going on? I mean, this is really interesting. So finally, the last thing I want to look at, and then I'll open it up to your we have some comments, and then your questions, comments, and tomatoes, whatever, is the connection between work time and sustainability. And this is very clear. The Swedish EPA and scientists at Chalmers University of Technology in Gothenburg, Sweden, have been doing a lot of important studies around the connection between work hours and a whole bunch of things, including life satisfaction, financial satisfaction, exercise, social connection, and greenhouse gas emissions. And what they find is that there's a significant drop-off in greenhouse gas emissions and climate impacts and carbon impacts when people work less. But there is not a significant drop-off in financial satisfaction. In fact, they find that people in Sweden who work 50 hours a week make well over twice as much as people who work 30 hours, but they have no greater financial satisfaction with their lives than the people who work 30 hours, and they contribute more than double the greenhouse gas emissions and other ecological footprint impacts. So I think I've given you a broad swath here, looked at a lot of things. I think we need, as a country, to start thinking about how are we going to measure well-being? How are we going to get away from this total emphasis on GDP and think about this? And we've got some possibilities. There's things like the Genuine Progress Indicator that various states are starting to do. I understand Utah is interested in this. And to really begin to turn this around so that our values are right on these things and people have a good life.